Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining. The song that I chose for tonight is called Yankel, which is really the word Yaakov, but in an endearing fashion. And the story fits into the category of what we call Jewish legends. By Jewish legends, we mean that the story is presumably true. We can't quite document it. Sometimes it's because of Lashon Hara reasons, we don't want to document it and tell you which rabbi it happened to. And if it didn't happen to the person we claim it happened to, it presumably happened to somebody else. We didn't just make up the story. There's a message to the story. As we say about Jewish legends, if it didn't happen, it could have happened. It carries a message of Judaism. There's an amazing story about Jewish legends said about the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim was brought into a Russian court as a character witness. One of the students in the yeshiva was accused of some crime, theft, whatever it was. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he was accused, and they brought the Chafetz Chaim in as a defense witness. Not that he was there and he could say the student didn't do it, but he could get up and say that this is not what we teach in our yeshiva, and he's not the type of person who would have done such a thing. So the defense lawyer, before he presented the Chafetz Chaim, tells the judge, "I'd just like you to understand who it is that I'm presenting to you." He says, "They say a story about the Chafetz Chaim that someone once broke into his little home and stole a bag of money. And as soon as it was discovered that this guy who had claimed he needed some hot food, and while they're puttering, he grabs the money and he runs out. As soon as it's discovered, the wife of the Chafetz Chaim screamed, like, it was a lot of money. And the Chafetz Chaim ran to the door and realized what had happened. And he calls after the person and says, "I forgive you, I forgive you. If you need the money, I forgive you." So the judge hears this story. And he says, "Sir, Mr. Lawyer, you really believe that story? You really believe that a human being can rise to such a level that he was just robbed and he could call after somebody? Apparently you need it more. Enjoy it." So the lawyer said, "Honestly, Your Honor, I don't believe the story. But I must tell you, they don't say stories like that about you and me." A legend can only fit a certain personality. It has to be the kind of person that the legend can stick to. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And the Chafetz Chaim was that type of person. For a legend to make it, besides the fact that there is enough evidence that the story presumably is true, but it has to fit the Jewish attitude. And that's something that we'll see in the story. Get ready to laugh.
In a little town somewhere in Europe, just about 100 years ago, lived a simple man whose name was Yanko. Oh, and this is how the story goes. Yanko couldn't learn a block in order, why he barely knew to read and write. He left him to the mitzvahs, but somehow he never seemed to get things right. He didn't know his brothers, couldn't sensation of my heart. He davened Shemoyne Esrei with his spread wide apart. Everyone would laugh and snicker when he passed them by in shul. Here comes Yankel Amo Oretz to never be a bigger fool. All the children would make fun of Yankel, teasing him as if he were a child. But he never ever lost his temper. On his face there always was a smile. And the rabbi tried to learn with Yankel, so the young man would know how to cope. In one year, but then out the other, the rabbi gave up, there simply was no hope. His Hebrew was atrocious, the place he'd always lose. He'd show up on Yom Kippur wearing shiny polished shoes. Everyone would laugh and snicker when he passed them by in shul. Here comes Yankel Amo Oretz, could there be a bigger
delightful song. A lot of different things we can spin off on. And if they're first impressions, we'll take them now. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I need translation of two phrases.
Okay, fair enough.
Blot Gemara.
A page of Talmud. He did in this song use a little bit of liberty. There are a few words here and there. Yeah.
Am Haaretz, is it a child of the earth?
Literally, yes. It means an ignorant person. A person who's just going with the flow and never became knowledgeable. What's the message? The message is that there was a person who was having trouble, was ridiculed, kept trying, and eventually got a vote of confidence from the rabbi and tried again. And he succeeded. And he succeeded awesomely, beyond everyone's expectation. And today, people look at him and say, Why couldn't we see that the gem just had to be polished? Very powerful concept. Yeah.
I think one of the turning points in here was when the rabbi saw that the way things had been going on were not the way to go. Sometimes we have to change our attitudes, and rather than saying, this is the wrong thing, this is the wrong thing, this is the wrong thing, like, oh, look, this person can do this right, they can do this right, and the person gets lifted up, and therefore they do another thing that's right. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the way the Chofetz Chaim would have taught someone with kindness rather than criticism, because you win more flies with honey than with vinegar.
Good. There's a positive energy. Again, the story is purposely sufficiently ambiguous. We don't know what technique was used, but we know that there was optimism to try again. And that carried the day. That's the message of the song. Somehow that optimism carried the day.
Everyone needs positive reinforcement. And I think this kid needed this kind of confidence on somebody's part, in this case, Rabbi. And it was essential. It was like a mental block, something like just...
Somehow, as a result of the prayer, of the yeshiva environment, of the optimism, the vote of confidence, somehow something cracked in the wall. And when he was able to crack that brick wall, he was able to succeed. I think that many of us, if you think about it, could see ourselves in Yankel in one way or another. Because every sincere person continues to grow, and that means that we turn to our behavior yesterday and think, to a certain extent, how stupid of me. I should have known better. We get better in life skills and relationships. And we think, remember how I handled that situation 5 years ago? That's crazy. Why did I do that? We learn new mitzvahs, and we wonder to ourselves, was I like Yankel, davening Shmona Esrei with my feet spread wide apart? Because no one ever told me that I'm supposed to keep them together. And there's an element in every person of this type of behavior. Yosef Mendelovich, great Russian refusnik, when he was in prison camp in then the Soviet Union, they baked matzahs. He has a whole story how they managed to get enough flour, and they managed to make an oven. They managed to bake matzahs. And they were careful to try to make the matzah and not chametz. It shouldn't rise. They worked quickly. He got to Israel, and one of the first things he wanted is they should show him a matzah bakery. So they showed him a matzah bakery, and he found out all the things that they do to make sure it doesn't become chametz. They run a roller over it so that it shouldn't pop up from the heat. How thin they make it, how hot the oven is. And he said thoughtfully, I'm sure that the matzahs we made in Russia under penalty of death, those matzahs were for sure chametz. The quote went into the newspaper, and my Rebbe got a hold of the newspaper, and he posted it on the bulletin board in Yeshiva, and next to the quote from Mendelovich, that they were for sure chametz, he wrote, Nichtov Bitzido, editor's note, in his own handwriting. He wrote, Kosher Mahajan Mina Mahajan. They were the elite kosher, more kosher than everyone's. Because in his mind, he was trying to do the mitzvah.
So intent is everything?
No. You will see in a moment. Do not draw conclusions. This is a full session. In his mind, he was trying to do it correctly, and what he did was very powerful, And no one can take that mitzvah from him, even if now, a few years later, he learns more and would never do the mitzvah the same way again. Take a look at quote number one. You'll notice that I divided our study tonight, perspectives, the before and the after. Yankel is going through a transition. He starts off in the before, and he's going to end up in the after. Quote number one. V'diglo alai ahava, a pasuk in Shir Hashirim, Song of Songs. The word diglo means that Hashem says, his banners are upon me with love. When the Jewish people surrounded the Mishkan in the desert, they surrounded it with their flags, their banners. God says, this is beloved to me. I like it. Jewish people in their encampments around me. But the word diglo, the Medrash takes as a play on words. Regarding an ignorant person who recites Shema, and instead of the word vi'ohavta, and you should love God, he doesn't know any better. He just passed our Hebrew reading course. And he says, vi'ayavta, you should hate God. If anybody knows Hebrew and they're paying attention, he mispronounced it. Hashem says, dilugo, even his mistake, alai ahava, is beloved to me. Diglo, dilugo, to play on words, and the Medrash says, he pronounced it ayavta, as if it's a commandment in the Torah to hate God. But he didn't mean that. He's struggling with the words, trying to say them. Hashem says, I love that Shema. You can't take it from him. Can't take that merit away. I heard this from Rabbi Friend. He said he was once standing by Simchas Torah dancing, and he noticed that a whole group of people who weren't familiar with the Hebrew songs were chanting along, but they were mispronouncing the words. And instead of saying, V'hivdi lanu min ha-to'im, we thank God because he separated us from those who stray, they were singing, V'hivdi lanu min ha-Torah, they separated us from Torah. Thank God, chanting along, you know, on Simchas Torah of all times. He separated us from Torah. And his first reaction was, oh no, someone's got to go in and correct this. And then he remembered this medrash. Diglo alai ahava. Even if you say v'ayavto in Shema, but they're hype. There'll be a time to take them aside and do the after, right? We're in before and we're after. Someday there'll be a time to call them aside and tell them that they're mispronouncing. But right now the perspective is the Medrash. Diglo alai ahava. Hashem loves that. They're sincere. They mean it. It's Yosef Mendelovich's matzah. Don't put an OU on it. But it's kasha mahajim in a mahajim. Yeah.
But yet we're so careful reading Torah.
Beautiful.
And
let's skip ahead of ourselves to quote number seven. Perspectives after the fact. When we're on track. When we're doing the mitzvah the way we're supposed to be doing it. Okay? Quote from Shulchan Aruch. A person should be careful as he recites Shema to pronounce the words correctly, not to slur one word into the next. For example, Bechol Levavcha, Al Levavchem. We don't want you saying Bechol Levavcha, Al Levavchem, Va'avadtem Mehera. To do it carefully, pronounce it correctly, certainly not to go ahead and say on the word v'ahavta, you should love, V'ayavta, that you should hate. In correct halacha, there's a correct way to do the mitzvah. I once met a young man who studied Bible on his own. He had no exposure to Judaism, but he knew he was Jewish. He got a hold of a chumash, and he was reading. He made himself a pair of tefillin. It says you should write them on your hand. You should put them on your head. And he made a contraption. He didn't know what you're supposed to write and how you're supposed to write. But he did realize that it was probably the word Shema Yisrael, because that's the statement of faith of the Jewish people. He wrote it. And he was wearing cardboard, whatever he was wearing. Now, you're going to teach him. And you're going to teach him that there's something called tefillin. And we have a tradition from Moshe how Hashem described tefillin should be made. But those cardboard boxes are something that you tell them to treasure. You put them away, you don't use them. But that's a treasure. That's a breakthrough. That's something that he worked on. And in his mind, at that time, that was the mitzvah, that's the before. And we don't want to take that from the person. You got to build. The guy's got to get the mitzvah right. But you don't take that from him. Person makes that mistake as a process of growth, that's something to be treasured. Now, another tremendous attribute that I felt emerged from the story of Yankel, I give you in number two. There's a statement in the Talmud, Gemara Shabbos, description of those who suffer insult but do not insult others. They're disgraced, they don't respond. They serve God with love and they are happy despite suffering. Regarding such people, there's a promise. His beloved shall be as the sun goes forth in its might. Beloved should equal, this person who is beloved to Hashem, should equal the sun in its strength, the rising sun. Does every single person who has these attributes become that? I don't know. But they're such a blessing. And if the person keeps knocking himself against the brick wall, you got to do it properly. You got to know how to knock against the brick wall, but with the right prayers, the right skills, the right effort, there's a blessing for such people. And that was the description that he painted this Yankel as a sincere, pleasant person. The kids would make fun of him, of his shoes. What would he do on Yom Kippur when he realized his mistake? I guess he would take off his shoes. What's he supposed to do? He didn't take his shoes and throw it at the kids. There's a blessing to such a person. And sometimes we feel we made a mistake. You turn around, you move forward, you keep going. And that's a tremendous attribute. But the topic that I'd like to dissect is, can one change their destiny? This young man, or middle-aged man, or whatever he is at this point, we would call him stupid. He's fool. He's the town fool. Can he get himself out of that? What's our attitude? What's the Jewish attitude? Yes. Oh, yes, but it ain't easy.
Keep trying.
Yeah. How do we handle the situation? Is his situation changeable? So the first reaction is quote number three. The angel appointed to conception at the moment that a person is conceived stands before God and asks, what shall be the destiny of this drop? Should the person be created strong or weak, wise or foolish, rich or poor? How should I do the DNA makeup? Righteous or wicked, by the way, is not asked at that time, because everything is in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven, and that's not God's business, whether the person will be righteous or wicked. All heaven takes care of is what kind of skills the person will have. But it seems that wise or foolish is decided at the moment of conception. What is the person's destiny? However, in Judaism, there's always one big however. Number four. Ein mazel liYisrael. We don't go with the systems of astrology. We don't attribute anything to the time that the person was born, conceived, all the calculations that anyone can come up with, even if they're correct. We don't go with that. Not because they're not true, but because the Jewish people are not limited by astrological signs. Through prayer and good deeds, one can change one's destiny for the better. And we had that 2 weeks ago in the Parsha. Avraham tells Hashem, what's going to be with me? I can't have children. Even in my astrological sign, it says I can't have children. And God said, get out of your astrological sign. I am now making you Jewish. And Jews are not limited to astrological signs. They're not limited to destinies. Ein mazel Yisrael. Prayer, charity, good deeds, you could change it. I just want to clarify that sometimes a person's handicaps are part of his mission. And if they're part of your mission, that's different. If God decided that fulfillment of your mission in this world is to serve Him through poverty, or serve Him through riches, then the better you are, the more He's not going to change it. Because that's your mission. And that's your role in this world. But if it's a side issue, whether you're getting enough blessing or it was decided originally to get enough blessing, all of that can be changed. For example, if Avram's mission in this world was to be the greatest human being that ever lived without a child, if that somehow would be linked to his destiny, so then that's his mission, okay. But if it's not his mission, it's just like the blessing ain't coming, so then we don't care if the blessing is not in the cards. We'll make it in the cards! And we'll change it. Yeah.
Is there any benefit to knowing the astrological nature of yourself, just so you can know what's going to be harder for you to work on?
So the answer is yes. There are benefits to knowing what one's starting point is, what one's predispositions are. However, most authorities say that it's forbidden to seek it out. You wouldn't be allowed to go for a reading, because that's a violation of Ein Mazel Yisrael. If, however, that information came your way, you discovered it. Or, I'll give you an example, where the astrologers informed you of the information, you're allowed to keep it in your mind, but you're not allowed to act upon it. I'll give you an illustration. Rabbi Akiva, who was a tremendously great person, and people were watching him. He was a celebrity. So the astrologers told him that based on the information they had about his daughter's birth, she would die on her wedding day. That's a nice birthday present to give the father, you know, to inform him that she would die on her wedding day. Rabbi Akiva apparently took the information and filed it away, but it didn't stop him from having his daughter prepare for marriage and to date and to choose a husband. You know, they were going through with the wedding preparations, and they're doing their merry thing. And after the wedding, she goes to the room that she prepared herself getting dressed, and she pulls her hairpin out of the wall and sees that it pierced a snake, a poisonous snake. And that as she stuck the hairpin in before the chuppah, she had killed the poisonous snake. So she let out a scream out of shock. And everybody came running. And Rabbi Akiva saw the snake. And he remembered. And he said, "My daughter, what merit did you do today that saved you?" And she said that the caterer had prepared meals for everybody, including herself, but because she was fasting, because it's her wedding day, she didn't need the meal. There was a beggar outside, and she took the meal and gave it to the beggar. Rabbi Akiva said, "Tzedakah tatzel mimaves." Shlomo HaMelech told us that tzedakah saves from death. And it did. There you have it. Your destiny was to die on your wedding day, but you gave your portion to a poor person, and it saved you. That's the Jewish attitude.
Yeah. I just have a quick question. If a non-Jew were to do that, they wouldn't be saved?
Our tradition of Ein Mazal Yisrael is that everything could be stacked perfectly in your destiny to be a problem, and you can simply rise above it with a merit. It depends how badly it's stacked.
Oh.
By us, it's not even an issue. Ein mazel Yisrael, your merits, it's normal to undo it. By the average human being, there certainly are powers to mitzvahs. Doing the right thing works. But it's not so simple. The Jewish attitude is you're not allowed to delve into those things because it's so easy to overcome it, and you would get so easily discouraged if the authoritative astrologer told you, "You are a person who gets angry." I mean, that kills the human being. And the Jew is expected to overcome that. Chick chock. Do some mitzvahs, overcome it, a little prayer, and let's go. What are you waiting around for? I once read, very cute, a creative writer in the newspaper. She writes that for years she was obsessed that because of her astrological sign — the newspaper astrological signs, by the way, are total baloney. It's for sport only. We're not even talking about that. But she was, you know, obsessed with her astrological sign. Fine. And she was convinced that's why she had trouble taking initiative. Her husband, on the other hand, always took initiative. He was a great guy, always jumping into new projects. Until one day, she checked his birth date and found out it's the same as hers. You know, the same part of the month or whatever. And she realized that it's all bogus. That's not the reason you're lacking in initiative. There may be a million other factors, but don't blame it on that. And she suddenly realized you're capable of lifting yourself out of it. But that's what happens to us. If you're told a discouraging concept, it makes a difference. And if you're told encouraging, it makes a difference. So we are forbidden to get involved in that type of science because we're being told it's so easy for you to overcome it that accepting that system as an element of truth is damaging to you. Not a good thing to do. Okay. Also, the way this, again, song, legend, story is painted, it's in consonance with our tradition, number 5. What should a person do if he wants to become wise? So the first answer of the Talmud is the traditional answer. Let him increase his studies and limit his other endeavors. So the Talmud challenges it and says, many have done that and have not succeeded. Many people who spend many hours studying and they limited their other endeavors. And at least according to the Talmud, I don't know, I've never seen this. Anybody that I've seen that did this formula did pretty nicely. But it's possible you increase your studies, you limit your other endeavors, you don't become obsessed at work, but you earn an honest living. And the Talmud challenges and says, it's still possible not to succeed. And the Talmud's conclusion is, you have to ask mercy from the one who owns wisdom. Who's that?
Hashem.
Gotta ask him. Gotta ask him to help you in your study. Yeah.
When they say, let him increase his studies, that means only the study of Torah or the study of just about anything and everything?
Our attitude in study is that you're studying Torah. To the extent that it's necessary, you need other logistics in order to understand what that law is. We're told, for example, that one of the great sages wanted to understand blemishes in animals because there are different cases regarding temple sacrifices. You have to know blemishes. If you don't know animals, you could study the book knowledge for years and not get anywhere. So he apprenticed himself, I believe the number is 3 years, to a shepherd so that he should understand animals. I know Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, who's a consultant for the OU, so he became an expert in meat. He apprenticed himself out for about 8 months to a butcher, reputable kosher butcher, and he said he didn't stop the apprenticeship until he could stick his hand into a barrel of meat and tell you which part of the animal he was holding and then pull it out and show you that that's what he was holding. You need such a high level of proficiency. So yes, there are other skills that you need, otherwise you don't understand how Torah applies. But when we say increased studies, we're talking about being extremely diligent in the study of Torah and whatever it takes that you should understand what you're studying. Number 6, finally, our last quote in the before, even if all the gates would be closed, the gates of tears don't close. And if there's no other way to be in touch with Hashem, because the issue at hand is no, we're not giving it to you, tears can melt the wall. And again, the story fits in Jewish tradition, in the way we appreciate such challenges. Let's move on to the perspectives, the before, and now the after. Yankel goes. What's he going to do? What's he trying to accomplish? What's his perspective?
He wants to serve Hashem.
He wants desperately to serve Hashem correctly. And he knows that he's making mistakes. What should he do about it? More than that, number 8, there's a law, anyone who benefits from this world without reciting a blessing is as if he stole from Hashem. You want to eat an apple? Borei pri ha'etz. Thank you, Hashem, for creating fruit of the tree. So you're stealing from God if you don't thank Him for it. He doesn't want you to pay Him for it. He wants you to thank Him for it, to notice that He thought of you. What's the solution? Let him go to a Torah scholar. So the Talmud challenges, what's that going to accomplish? You've already eaten the fruit without reciting the blessing. What does going to a Torah scholar accomplish? You know, parenthetically, in some religions, there's such a concept. After you've done the wrong, you go to the clergy,
they absolve you.
You pay it off, and you're absolved. The Talmud says, you can go to as many Torah scholars as you want afterwards, but you still didn't recite the blessing. What's it going to do for you? Rava explained, let him go to the Torah scholar to begin with, so that he should be taught blessings, and he will not come to do the wrong thing. It's an attitude of rectifying life. I want to do the right thing. And that's what this Yankel's goal is as he comes to the yeshiva. Now he knocks on the front door to the yeshiva. What do they tell him?
Go away.
Get lost. No. Now, what are they going to tell him?
Why are you here?
Okay. And what's his answer?
To learn.
Good. Quote number 9. Jewish people were crowned with 3 crowns. Torah, Kuhuna, priesthood, and monarchy. The crown of Kuhuna, priesthood, was given to Aaron. The crown of monarchy was given to David. You have to be a descendant of them to be in. It's one segment of the Jewish people. But the crown of Torah remains for the entire Jewish people. As it's written, Torah was commanded to us through Moshe, an inheritance for the entire Jewish people. Whoever wants can come and have the crown of Torah. Meritocracy. Nothing to do with being the descendant of a specific segment of the Jewish people. You're Jewish, you're entitled to the crown if you earn it. It sometimes goes from father to son, but it has nothing to do with being linked from father to son. If the father cares enough, spends enough time with the son, and the son is amiable, it could go father to son. And that's our prayer. Number 10, every morning, V'ha'arevna, please sweeten your Torah in our mouths. May we, our descendants, and the descendants of the entire Jewish people, be knowledgeable in Torah. I want to share with you one final thought. There's a great Torah personality that we all familiar with by the name of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was a Yankel. He was a very noble, friendly, nice person who was an Amoritz, ignorant of Torah, until the age of 40. What changed?
Change in destiny.
What changed is that he met a woman by the name of Rachel. And this Rachel was the equivalent of a princess. Her father was among the wealthiest people in the Jewish people. He was able, if need be, to support the people of Jerusalem for years. If there would be a siege from the Romans, which they feared, he had enough assets to cover everything. No problem. He'll import the wheat, he'll take care of it. And this is his daughter. And the daughter, this Rachel, noticed something special about Akiva the shepherd. And they got to talking, And she said to him, if we got married, would you go study Torah? Would you try to become a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar? And he said, yes. They knew that the father would have a fit, because this is his daughter, and he could marry her off to a real Torah scholar. What are you taking an ignorant shepherd for? And it's clear that he was not objecting to the social class issue. It was clear that he's objecting to, he's not a scholarly Jew. Why would you want him as a husband? And this girl has the world open for her. So she went privately and got married to this Akiva, the shepherd. Things were very difficult for them. The father wouldn't support them in any way. He made declarations that he's disowning her. No one wanted to give Akiva work, because if the wealthiest guy in town is upset, who wants to get involved? And they had it very rough. And one day, Rachel tells him, you remember the agreement we had before we got married that you were going to go study Torah? Well, let's do it. Go. And he listed all the objections. Who's going to bring food? Who's going to fix the house? Who's going to do this? Who's going to... Go! And he went. He went and he joined the lecture. And he didn't understand what was going on. Wasn't going in. Maybe the lecture was too difficult for him. Maybe there was just a brick wall. He wasn't getting it. Despondent, he's ready to come home and tell his wife, listen, I tried. But they are right. I'm an ignorant shepherd. And it's not working. And on his way home, he has a moment of inspiration. He sees a rock by a waterfall. It's not a big waterfall. It's just a drip, drip, drip. But eventually the drip has created a crevice in the stone, smoothed it out, made a crevice. And he says to himself, if water, which is soft, can eat away at a stone that's hard, then Torah, with persistence, will eventually penetrate the human mind. And he does an about-face, and instead of going home, he goes back to the yeshiva, and he asks them to figure out a different study pattern for him, and he starts with Aleph Beis, and he goes through Chumash, Mishnayos, methodically, until he reaches the same lecture hall that he had wanted to enter as an adult, and now he's able to do it. And before long, he becomes the leader of the Jewish people. He finally makes it back to his hometown, and news gets out. The great Rabbi Akiva is coming to visit, and he was heading home, because his mission's accomplished. He wants to go back to his wife. And his wife comes to where the entourage is entering town and setting up shop. And she makes her way through. You can only imagine. Excuse me! Excuse me! She finally makes her way in. Who are you? Everyone's asking. Who is this lady? And as she gets close, Rabbi Akiva sees her, recognizes her, and motions to everybody, make way for her, give her a seat. Sheshali v'shalochem shalahu. Because everything that I have and everything that you have all belongs to her. Why does it all belong to her? She's the one who gave the encouraging word and said, you can do it. Every person needs in their life somebody who says to them, you can do it. Some people are fortunate, they get it from their parents. Some people, their parents don't understand what's involved. You get it from a spouse, you get it from a friend. In our class, you get it from the rabbi. The rabbi says, you can do it. And that's to a great extent the story of Yankel. And it's the story of Rabbi Akiva. It's the story of many great people. Somebody got up and said, you can do it. And the minute the rabbi says to Yankel, you can do it! With a prayer like that, I believe in you. Hashem's not going to turn you down. Go for the gold, you'll succeed. And the punchline is that he's right.
Tears, and everybody stands to shake his hand when he passes. bread and shoe. Here comes the apple town and fluffy. How can we have been such fools?
Closing comments.
I have one.
Yeah.
I noticed this time that the thing about his prayer was that he was asking, you know, we all have our wants and our desires, and we can turn to Hashem with them, but if the thing behind our wants and desires is to serve Hashem, if we're asking for the right reasons, then...
Very powerful.
Yeah, then no matter what it is that we're asking for, I mean, if you want a bigger car so that you can drive people around and perform chesed, you know.
Correct. If a person defines their wants through a Torah perspective, give me health so that. Yeah. If the so that is good, then even the personal request is a spiritual growth. Yeah.
Well, it seems like the most emphasis was put on Yanko. But I want to make a point. It's not just about Yankel, it's about all of us. An ability to see in even the most hopeless child or adult something which can be truly shining if you allow to open, reveal.
We need to be reminded that when we think of writing someone off, we might be the fools. And that the chorus is that he's the fool until the final stanza. And you got to be open to that idea. Yeah.
Well, what I think that sometimes the majority of the people they used to some type of action, some type of behavior. And if person acting differently, he's suddenly, you know, the decision is being made that he's strange or, you know, maybe fool. So sometimes you have to be very careful to make a judgment.
I want to point out that sometimes those judgments are not even conscious. They're just like if we're all dressed in a certain way, let's say, like on Shabbos, and one person is dressed differently. I mean, I'm very careful not to judge people. I have a natural gift that I don't even notice. I'm just oblivious sometimes. But there is a double take if someone is dressed differently. I had a phenomenal experience recently. Everybody was wearing shoes because it was Shabbos. And I take a double take. One person's wearing high top sneakers. I wouldn't say anything. Nothing. I mean, but it's just like, I took a double, like, huh? What? Oh, okay. Well, I mean, they're prerogative. And then I stopped. He walked here. He walked 3 miles. He put those sneakers on so that he could do it. Those are holy sneakers. If you don't know the whole story, you don't even stand a chance to be able to judge. And even if you do know the whole story, we do. We take double takes. If someone's odd, we have to remind ourselves. You know, by nature, you're going to notice. Everyone's wearing blue shirt, and there's one person with a yellow one. You want to know, is he the conductor? I mean, what's his story? You take a double take just because it's unusual. And yes, we have to be reminded that that external, or whatever it is, skills, everything, that's not the ultimate judgment of the person. Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful, wonderful week.
You have been listening to a lecture by Rabbi Mordechai Rein. For more information, or to bring Rabbi Ryan as a guest lecturer to your community, please call 908-770-9072 or email rmryan@teach613.org. You can also visit us on the web at teach613.org.